Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 687 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Superman Sunday episode, and I'm going to be continuing the Superman chronology with World of Metropolis number 2. Just a quick reminder what World of Metropolis is. Much like World of Krypton and World of Smallville, it's sort of a prequel to John Byrne's start of his Superman run, his post-crisis reimagining of the Man of Steel. And we got the six-issue Man of Steel miniseries from Byrne that really gave us sort of the origin and the new beginning of Superman. First time he decided to use his powers in public and go into Metropolis for the first time. But then when the regular series started for Byrne to tell his stories, Superman was a known quantity to Metropolis. He had been around for a long time. He was trusted. So it wasn't like Byrne was starting from scratch. And so in order to give some context and some texture to the stories he was telling, we needed to know about these the reimagined or the repurposed origins of a lot of these other characters. Like, how did Perry White come to be the managing editor? How did Lois Lane get her job at the Daily Planet? What about Ma and Pa Kent and Smallville? What about Lana Lang? What about Superman's heritage as a Kryptonian? What was Krypton like in this version of the Superman mythos? So we already got the heritage and the history, the thousands of years of history of Krypton and the World of Krypton series. And now in World of Metropolis, we're getting an idea of who these supporting characters at the Daily Planet are. So the first issue of World Metropolis focused on Perry White. We already talked about that in a previous episode. Now, issue 2, as I said, focuses on Lois Lane. The argument could be made that next to Superman, Lois Lane is the single most important character in Superman's history, in Superman comics. Some would even argue that in her own way, Lois Lane is even more heroic than Superman because she puts herself in a lot of the same types of situations, same amount of danger Superman has put himself in the past, but she does it without the benefit of superpowers. Now, some of that she might do because she knows in her back pocket she has Superman there to protect her. But I honestly feel like even if she didn't have that safety net, she would still do the things that she does. She just has a sense of invincibility, even though we know that not to be the case. But she, and I'm almost not even sure why she does it. Clearly, she's dedicated to her job and she's passionate about uncovering the truth and getting to the bottom of a story. But it seems to me that even if you are dedicated and you're trying to uncover corruption, or you're trying to fight for the little guy, or whatever it might be, you want to get at the truth, it's still going to be tempered by making logical decisions and not being super impulsive and just some kind of a survival instinct, right? Lois doesn't necessarily have that. Like, she is willing to risk so much. And you wonder, like, if you weigh it on balance, right? Thinking, okay, I'm going to take this incredible risk that may pay off and give me the story of a lifetime, or uncover this secret, or break the story wide open, whatever it might be. But the chances are great that I'm going to be hurt or killed, in which case I no longer will be able to do any good down the line. You weigh those things and you would think that, okay, being a little cautious or exercising a little restraint so that you can continue to do good in the world for a longer period of time, that eventually that's going to outweigh the decision of the moment that has such a small chance of success. But Lois seems to only focus on what is right in front of her. And I don't know that that's ever been really explained why that is. I think it would make an interesting story to tell, or an interesting title to focus on Lois and to explore that. Don't know that it would necessarily work now that she's married to Superman. I think the dynamics have changed a little bit. And then, of course, what we've seen Brian Michael Bendis do with her in his current run of Superman, I'm not even sure where Lois stands right now. I'm not even sure who she is right now. And it's funny because Bendis has talked about how he considers Lois to be the most heroic person in the DC universe. He really admires her. But then, you know, he brought her back and she lied, even though if it was a lie of omission, by not telling Superman she was back. And now she's talking about them living kind of separate but equal lives. It just doesn't, it's a real mess right now. And so I'm not really sure how it's all going to play out. I do know, based on some recent solicits, that there is a story coming up that focuses on Lois and Clark rather than Lois and Superman, but on Lois and Clark as reporters working on a story together. And that may give us some insight into ultimately who Lois Lane is to Brian Michael Bendis. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. But let's go ahead and dive into World of Metropolis number 2. It's written by John Byrne. We have Wynn Mortimer handling the pencils once again. We have Dick Giordano and Sal Trapani on inks. Bill Oakley is handling the letters, and Todd Zuko is on colors. So the issue opens up, says Superman's girlfriend Lois Lane, and the title of the issue is How I Spent My Summer Vacation. Lois is running through a burning building, like only Lois Lane would do, in an A-line skirt and high heels. And she's thinking to herself, she's coughing, and I can't take much more of this. Where is she? And she's like, wait, up again? These stairs don't really look like they're in great shape, but it makes sense that she'd keep climbing to get away from the flames. And she's calling out for Wanda. Wanda, where are you? Come on, baby, show yourself. She gets up to another flight of stairs, saying, Wanda, come on now, don't hide from me. And then all of a sudden, there, and now if that's only her, I've only got about 5 more minutes. And she throws open a door, Wanda, there you are. And it turns out that it's a dog that she's been looking for. And she says, bad girl, you're supposed to come when you're called. Now look at the mess we're in. And so the dog comes over, kind of whining to Lois and saying, yeah, I've got a reputation to protect as a really tough girl. So don't tell anybody about how I was being overcome by these flames. And so she's like, okay, now for my next magic trick, let's see if I can get us both out of here. So as she approaches the window, she sees that the firefighters have arrived outside. And she says, thinks to herself rather, well, maybe Lucy was right. I should have waited, Lucy being her sister. But if she'd done that, it's likely that Wanda would have been one cooked pooch. So what Lois does is she throws a chair out the window, which allows her to climb up onto the windowsill, and it also kind of alerts the firemen of the fact that there's somebody up there. And the firemen bring a net over. Lois tosses the dog out. The dog lands safely. And just as Lois is about to jump out and follow the dog to safety, to jump out on the net, the ledge and the wall of the building crumbles underneath her. But Superman is there just in time to grab her, saying, hang on, Lois, as they're not out of the woods yet. With all the crumbling debris headed for the firefighters, Superman basically uses his heat vision to turn it into dust so that nobody is hurt. Meanwhile, Wanda seems none the worse for wear, having been reunited with Lucy. And Superman demurs when Lucy says, you know, thanks for saving him. I really appreciate it. And Superman says, all in a day's work. These firefighters are out here risking their lives without any superpowers. They're the ones that really deserve all the adulation. So Lois apologizes to Lucy for her having lost her apartment. She says, you've lost everything. It must be really tough. And Lucy says, I guess it really hasn't hit me yet. Everything's happened so fast. And Lois invites her to come stay with her until she can get back on her feet. And then says, well, and at least it's Saturday. You won't have to go into your job or face your coworkers until Monday. So later, the two sisters are sitting on Lois's living room floor, eating pizza, watching old movies. And Lois asks how Lucy's feeling. And she says, I guess I'm still waiting for it to all come together in my mind, right? There was a lot of life wrapped up in those three little rooms and a lot of memories, both good and bad. And she's thinking about when Lois first persuaded her to move out on her own, how it seemed like such a big step. And it wasn't as hard for Lucy as it probably was for Lois, right? Although Lois was more than happy to move out because their dad was always disappointed in her, it seems. And Lois says, yeah, he could never get used to the idea of his firstborn being a girl. He wanted a son so badly, he tried to turn me into one. So again, Byrne is using this this issue to give us a background on what the relationship's like give us a better understanding of Lois and what her childhood was like, so we can get some insight into why she does the things she does and takes the risks that she does and things like that. And Lois goes on to say, yes, Dad took all that out on me, and by the time you came around, he'd mellowed out quite a bit. And Lucy says, yeah, you think he'll ever be able to forgive him? And Lois says, well, he'll have to forgive himself first. And again, a lot of this may have changed. You know, General Sam, this doesn't sound like the General Sam Lane that we've seen recently. He doesn't seem to have any problem with kind of the, I won't say abusive, but the harsh upbringing of Lois Lane and wanting her to basically have been a boy. I don't think that General Sam Lane is feeling guilty about that or harboring any feelings or thoughts about that at all. But apparently, when Byrne first was considering the way Lois's parents were, that was a consideration. So Lois goes on to say, you know what? I don't want to dwell on that now. You know what this is reminding me of, sitting here eating pizza and watching an old movie? Do you remember when I first went after my job at the Daily Planet? And Lucy's like, how could I forget? So we get a flashback of Lois striding into the Daily Planet offices, Lucy in tow, walks right up to Perry White, says, hey, do you remember me? And Lucy's there behind saying, I want to go to a movie. You're supposed to be taking me to a movie. Of course, Perry has no idea who Lois is. And she says, yeah, don't you remember? It was when you were yelling at your old boss. I was here telling you, thumbs up, way to go. You know, I was here with my class, remember? You got to remember that. Perry's like, does this kid belong to anybody? And she goes on to say, I belong to myself. Unless the Daily Planet wants me, then I'm all yours for the asking. And Perry's like, young lady, do you think you could say something that makes sense? And Lois says, oh, sure. Yeah. Right. Like, it's like a test, right? A good reporter has to be precise, has to be clear. That's what I'm going to be. The best reporter's papers ever had. And Perry's like, wait, you're looking for a job? How old are you? And Lois lies and says, I'm 19. I'll be 20 on my next birthday. Perry's like, 19, huh? And meanwhile, Lucy totally lets the cat out of the bag, saying, Lois, I'm going to tell Mom you've been fibbing. You're not 19. You're only 15, which confirms Perry's suspicions. And he ushers them out, saying, sorry, miss, we're not hiring today. Come back in 10 years. And Lois is like, but. And once the doors are closed, Lois kind of lays into Lucy, saying, I don't believe it. Doesn't he know what chance he's passing up on? And again, Lucy, Lois, I want to go to a movie. Lois is like, would you shut up about your movie? I got to think. And she like balls up her fists. And Lucy's like, you better not hit me. I'll tell Dad. So Lois, all right, let's go. Let's go to the movie. But man, you're going to suffer for this kid. And as they head to the elevator, they overhear a couple of reporters coming in. They're talking about Lex Luthor, how something big's going to go down that very night, but nobody will be able to get close to LexCorp headquarters because it's going to be shut down tighter than a drum. And if only one of them could get in, they could kind of make their career if they could find out what's going on at LexCorp that evening. And Lois, of course, overhears this, and she thinks of Luthor. Meanwhile, Lucy's still saying, I want to go to the movie. Lois, okay. Meanwhile, 3 hours later, back at the girl's apartment, Lois is getting dressed to go out. Lucy's saying, you're going to get in trouble. Lois says, no, I won't. Not if you don't blab on me, and you're not going to, right? Now help me set up these pillows. So she sets up some pillows to make it look like she's still in her bed. She climbs down the emergency fire escape ladder, sneaks off the army base that she's on without being spotted, which turns out to be pretty easy once a car pulls up to the gate and the guard is distracted. So she hitches a ride to Metropolis, and soon enough, she's at the base of the LexCorp headquarters looking up, trying to figure out how she's going to get in, because there's a doorman who looks like he's paying a lot more attention than that doofus at the base, Lois thinks. But what she does find is there is a sculpture outside, some modern art, And it just so happens right above that sculpture is a scaffolding for window washers. And so she thinks, all this rock climbing that Dad made me do will finally pay off. She's able to climb up the sculpture, get onto the scaffolding, and use it to basically go up to the top of LexCorp Tower. Once she gets up there, it's a kind of a hop, skip, and a jump to a balcony with an open sliding glass door that she's able to get into LexCorp from. But this is super dangerous. I mean, she never stops to think at all, apparently, about what would happen if you fall. What happens if you don't make that jump? I mean, she's got to be at least 25, 30 stories up. But she thinks, you know what? I haven't made it this far and risked getting grounded for life to be stopped now. And she does make the leap. And she's actually on the ledge of Luther's office. And she thinks, as she looks in the window, well, there's the big man himself. This is even better than I hoped for. Maybe I can catch him with his fingers dirty, just like Mr. White wants. So as Lex is giving orders, nothing seems terribly incriminating. Lois is kind of listening in and thinking, if only something would distract him, it would give me a few minutes to look through his desk. And no sooner does she say that than the scaffolding kind of rattles against the window, makes noise, and Luther says, what is that? So everyone goes rushing out to the balcony while his assistants are saying, we should call security. He says, nonsense, if there's somebody out there, I'm out here, I'm perfectly capable of handling themselves. So as he peers off the side of the balcony, he sees the scaffolding. He's wondering, what's that doing up here? It should have been secured below for the night. Lois has taken the opportunity to sneak in, and she grabs this big stack of papers off his desk and takes off running. Luther says, stop her, stop her. And Lois is thinking, don't stop, keep running. There's got to be a way out of this. And so she loses them momentarily. She hits the fire exit and she thinks, you know, everybody's going to think that I'm going to be heading down, but I think I'll actually head up. It'll give me a few moments to figure out what to do. Maybe I can find a service elevator that doesn't open on the main lobby. I can get down to the basement and from there I can find a way out. But unfortunately, while everybody else may have gone down, Luther went up. He anticipated that she might go up instead of down, and he grabs a hold of her and says, wow, you're a girl. You're just a little girl, but a pretty little girl nonetheless. And shortly, Lois is shown back into his office after she's been strip searched by one of Luther's security detail, and it found nothing. The security officer even says, I shredded her clothes looking for hidden pockets, but I didn't find anything. And Lois says, you're going to have to replace those clothes, wise guy. If my dad hears about this. And Luther says, you know, I don't imagine he'll present us with any more difficulty than you have. And again, Luther has no idea who her father is. Lois hasn't said who she is and is not about to. And Luther says, you know, I don't know who you might be working for, young lady, but if they employ people as incompetent as you, I can't imagine they're any sort of risk to me. And Lois says, I don't work for anybody. I'm here on my own. And Luther says, you know what? I'm inclined to believe you. I can't believe even my most devious opponent would concoct a harebrained scheme like sending a little girl to spy on me, especially when it netted you nothing. And she says, still, I hate to see you leave with nothing to remember this evening by. And he's handed a switch of all things and tells his security officer, Miss Parker, to hold Lois tight. So the next page, we see her thrown out of the building and she's kind of rubbing her backside. So the implication, obviously, that Luther gave her a spanking, actually. I don't think that would fly these days in a comic. Way too much innuendo. And yeah, let's just leave it at that. So anyway, as Luther watches on a camera, she walks away. And one of his security officers is saying, I guess she won't be bothering us anymore, huh, Mr. L? And Luther says, you know, I wouldn't be too sure about that. There's something there, a fire in her eyes. And I'd be interested in seeing where she is in 10 years. For now, however, I'm just going to content myself with another look at the videotape of the strip search, which I don't know that would fly either. That is super creepy. it's basically child pornography that Luther has. I mean, gross. Yeah, really, really in poor taste. Definitely wouldn't fly these days. But anyway, meanwhile, out on the street, as Lois is walking down the street, she reaches into her mouth and pulls out a little piece of paper. She apparently had wadded up something and saved it there, so she didn't leave empty-handed after all. Once she returns home, sneaks back in. Lucy is there as well. She's also snuck out of bed, and she's sitting on the floor of the living room watching old movies, eating pizza. And so this is exactly why Lucy and Lois, sitting on Lois's apartment floor watching old movies, eating pizza, has brought up these memories. So Lois seems a little sore after the spanking she got. But she says, "Give me some of that pie, kid, and don't ask too many questions. Because if you do ask too many questions, I won't persuade Mom to let you come into the city with me again tomorrow when I go to see Perry White about that job." And then back in the present day, Lois is saying, "Yep, old movies and pizza. It always reminds me of that night. And it's amazing to think you got away with it," says Lucy, "and it got you your job at the Daily Planet." And Lois says, "Yeah, I had no idea what was on that piece of paper when I stuffed it into my mouth. It was just lucky that it had something of worth to Perry. It wasn't anything he could publish or use. Luther's always been, you know, too clever for that to have anything stick. But it was enough to convince Perry that he was right in thinking that Luther was rotten and not squeaky clean as he wanted the world to think. And it definitely was enough to convince Perry that Lois was exactly the kind of reporter that Perry had been. And give her a chance even at the young age of 15. And then Lucy says, "You know, I've always wondered about one thing, though. That videotape, how did you know that he had it? Did you know Luther was taping you?" And she says, "No, actually, I didn't. If I had at the time, I would have ripped his spleen out. But no, the slime bucket sent me a copy once I started making a name for myself at the Planet. I guess he recognized me from that night." And Lucy says, "Well, you don't think he still has a copy, do you?" And Lois says, "Oh, I bet he does. After all those years of trying to add me to his collection, I'm pretty sure he's content with his facsimile." And that's how the issue ends. So, yeah, again, this was written in the mid-80s. I don't think that would make it through editorial these days. Underage girl tape strip search. Yeah, not going to fly. And just super, super creepy. Like I said, it's basically child pornography. It's totally gross. But it does give us some idea of who Lois is and the fact that she's willing to take these risks and do anything for a story. But again, I don't know that the motivations for that have ever been fully examined. And I would love to see, I'd love to see certain writers take that on. Maybe Greg Rucka would be a good writer to kind of examine that, or Kelly Sue DeConnick might be another one. I did hear a rumor at one point, I thought, of Matt Fraction doing a Lois comic, or was it Greg? Maybe it was Greg Rucka that was, and Matt Fraction was the Jimmy Olsen comic. I definitely would be down for either one of those, because I think there is a lot to explore there. And as I said, Brian Michael Bendis appears to have a soft spot in his heart for Lois Lane as well. So it wouldn't surprise me to see at least a Lois Lane miniseries come down the pipe. That would be great. As far as the art in the issue, the art style doesn't suit this story as well as it suits the first story, just because this is a little more modern. And you still get kind of that Wayne Boring, Kurt Swan vibe. But, you know, not to be totally sexist, these aren't square-jawed male characters like in the first issue with Perry White. And so the style doesn't quite suit the story as well as it does in the first issue, but it's still very good art and very classic art and does have a little bit of a kind of a Silver Age feel. But again, you almost think it would be better because it's a modern story, if it had a little bit more modern art. But it's a very minor nitpick overall. The storytelling is strong. The line work is good. The color work is okay. I mean, this is an 80s comic with, you know, it's on newsprint. So the colors aren't going to be, you know, bright and vibrant or anything like that. So it's certainly better than average art. I don't really have a problem with it at all. I just wonder if the story would have felt a little more dynamic with more modern art, as opposed to this more classic, almost late 60s, early 70s type of art. So I think that's going to do it for this episode. We want to thank everybody for joining as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.